She got here just a few minutes after the shooting began.
Stike sniffed again. Still nothing.
You sure?
Celine seemed to wake up fully, her expression growing startled.
Oh, no.
Well?
I was supposed to tell you something when you got back. Carl Pohl said she was going to find the Dainai's camp.
She what?
Stike and Abana both asked at the same time.
Stike ran to Celine's side, kneeling down beside her so their faces were inches apart.
Tell me exactly what happened.
Nothing happened. She just told me to tell you she had gone to find the enemy camp. She needed information.
How is she supposed to find the enemy camp if we haven't been able to for...
Stike trailed off.
Pit.
She must have picked up some bit of detritus that allowed her to track them.
What the pit are we supposed to do?
She said to come get her in the morning,
Celine said.
Stike exchanged a look with Ibana. For a week they hadn't had any luck finding the Dainai's dragoons, and the bastards had shadowed them for far longer than that. Finding their camp now, without Karpol's sorcery, might be next to impossible. He felt sick to his stomach at the idea of having ridden clear across for Traster, only to lose the ward they were supposed to be protecting. And he was mad as shit that she'd just gone off without saying a word to anyone except a little girl.
We leave her,
he spat. Ibana seemed startled by the suggestion.
She's the whole reason we're here.
And she damn well abandoned us. We're a bodyguard, not a valet service. We're not going to just come by and pick her up. These dragoons have caused us more grief than any cavalry I can remember, and I'm not going to go looking for them.
Stike was furious.
He knew he wasn't thinking clearly, but he didn't care.
Major Gerstar will be spitting mad, Ibana cautioned. He's here to find the Godstone on orders of Lady Flint. If we abandon that mission, he'll likely take his rifle jacks and go.
Let him.
Stike squeezed his hands into fists, wishing he had somewhere to strangle.
Ibana remained silent. Her usual sour expression had been replaced by somber acceptance.
What will we do?
She asked quietly.
Join the war. Head back and find something to fight. There's no need lacking for good cavalry.
Then,
Celine said.
What?
He growled. He caught her eye and forced himself to take a breath.
What?
He repeated in a gentler tone.
You can't leave Pohl.
I'm not leaving her. She left us.
You left the rest of the group on your own mission, Celine pointed out. Just the other day.
I told everyone I was going, Stike said. I didn't just off and...
He squeezed his fists tightly until he could feel his ring biting into the skin of his finger.
This isn't the same thing at all.
Celine stood up straighter, fixing Stike with a scowl.
You're her bodyguard, she insisted. She anointed you. I don't know what that means, but it sounds important. She just went to get information. We can find her and keep going.
She folded her arms.
Or you can leave me behind, too. I'll go find her myself.
Stike would have laughed at the image of a child telling off a crippled giant, if he wasn't already so angry. He forced himself to calm down, breathing evenly, trying to make himself think. After a few moments, he strode off into the darkness.
Then, where are you going?
Ibana called after him.
Stike found Felizia playing cards with several of her scouts around a small campfire. He came up behind them, picking Felizia up by the back of her shirt and holding her at eye level. She blinked at him, licking her lips, while the others watched in silence.
"Can I help you, boss?"
she squeaked.
"No rest for the wicked,"
he told her.
"Find me those dragoons. Find me where the survivors are camping. And do it before daybreak."
Chapter 45 Flora spent another day watching the veil, only to see the guard double and the shipments become more frequent and more thoroughly watched. The next afternoon, she visited one of the local hardware stores for rope, and waited till dusk before setting out. She took a long route, climbing the base of the mountain just as darkness fully claimed the valley, and positioning herself about 100 yards from the entrance to the vale on a steep, but not completely impassable, part of the cliff that led up and over to Jez's territory. She had two problems, the way she saw it. The first was that she had to climb in the dark, risking her neck on an untried route. Her second problem was that she had no idea what to expect on the other side. A steep scree that would be impossible to descend quietly? A gentle hill? Or just a straight drop down into the vale? A strong powder trance heightened her vision enough that climbing in the dark was, while still risky, not as perilous as it might be to another person. She began her ascent quickly, visualizing the path she'd laid out, and climbing more by feel than by sight. She had just enough experience climbing to know that her route would be easy for someone carrying the right gear, and dangerous for an amateur. She used her sorcerous strength to bridge the gap by keeping impossible holds with two fingers, climbing over shelves, and in one case, leaping straight up the side of the cliff for the next handhold. She made it to the top of the cliff without incident, where she secured her two ropes. The first, she dropped back the way she'd come, so the descent would be easier. The second, she carried with her to the other side of the cliff and looked down into the vale. Once again, Flaring's description was spot on. Nighttime Vale was a wide, secluded valley with a creek running through the centre. At one point it might have been picturesque, but the trees had been ripped up, the creek diverted into gold-panning sluices, and the ground covered in debris and a forest of dirty tents belonging to miners. It was a whole different town up here, and it extended on for a good mile before winding its way up into the mountains. Flora picked out the guards easily. They wandered the tents in regular intervals, carrying torches and blunderbusses. Others perched up on the mountainside, guarding the entrances to the mines with rifles, lest some enterprising miner slip down in to recover a lucky gold nugget. Security was tight. And once again, Flora couldn't tell if it was because Jessie wanted to keep her most profitable mine safe, or if she was hiding the excavation of the Godstone. The way down was steep, but not impassable. Flora paid out the rope as she went, giving herself a guide for getting back up, and proceeded as quietly as possible. She reached the bottom and then began to make a wide circuit around the miners' camp, keeping eyes peeled for anything that would have looked out of place in the other valleys. Her first target was an open pit at the very opposite end of the valley. Creeping slowly, she slipped past the guard stand and down to the creek, then made her way uphill past the panning sluices and across what had probably once been a field of wild flowers. It was a muddy cesspool now, and she grimaced with each squelch her boots made. She was able to reach the edge of the pit without raising an alarm, and knelt beside it as she peered downward, searching the depths for anything of question. Nothing stood out. No sharp angles, no special equipment. She opened her third eye to look into the else, and had no better luck. No colour of sorcery. When she turned and swept the veil with her vision, it came up with the same story. If there was sorcery at work here, it must be well hidden. A previous fear crept into her thoughts as she studied the veil. What if Prime Lecter was working for Lindet? Never mind the why or the how. The implications were terrible. He had the knowledge of thousands of years in his head, and Lindet had the ambition to use that knowledge. If they were working together for some reason, Lindit suddenly became a more dangerous threat than even the Dianais. Flora attempted to ignore the worrisome niggle and continued her circuit of the valley. She reached out with her sorcerer's senses, each moment accompanied by the feeling that something was out there. Pinpointing the source of that feeling was like nailing down a shadow, and she was forced to attribute it to her imagination and keep walking. Stones shifted beneath her feet, and on one occasion a guard called into the darkness. But she managed to finish off her search without raising an alarm, finding herself back up on the cliff with her ropes several hours after she'd crossed the cliffs. Frustration gripped her. Nothing. Absolutely nothing. It was just a damned gold mine without any secrets, and she'd risked her neck and wasted her entire week on a gamble that the stone was up here. She wanted to kill something, errantly wishing that an alarm would be raised so she could fight her way through. She silenced the foolish thought and returned the way she'd come, climbing her rope down into the next valley. She returned to her hotel room, where she examined a number of cuts on her hands and forearms earned from climbing a cliff in the dark. She cleaned up and wrapped the cuts on her forearms. It was almost 3 in the morning when she finally rolled into bed, unable to think about anything except how mad she was. In the morning, she would have to go to Taniel and tell him her gamble had failed. He would soon be released, and they'd have to hunt down Prime together. And if that failed, she would have no choice but to bring in the Riflejacks. An army would bring Prime out of hiding, for certain. But would he slaughter them all before she and Taniel could kill him? She was just drifting off to sleep when a sound brought her bolt upright in bed. She looked around, trying to find the source of it. Nearly a minute passed before the sound happened again, and several seconds later she heard something different. The distant, familiar noise of a rifle shot. Flora saw the bullet holes in her wall the same moment she heard the shot. Her heart suddenly beating hard at the close miss, she gathered her things as quickly as possible and left her room, trying not to sprint. Nohan had found her, and he was out there taking pot shots at her room like it was some sort of game. It was a damn good thing he was a bad shot. She tried to find him, reaching out with her senses, but at this range and without the rising powder smoke to guide her, it was an impossible task. She left her horse in the hotel stable and crossed the city by foot. There was still plenty of noise at this time of night, with dozens of brothels and bars open for business to miners celebrating a good day or lamenting a bad one. Brown Bear Burt's brothel was one such establishment, and she slipped inside and looked up to the second level, where she could see Burt sitting at his desk in a robe and pajamas, cigar in hand.
"I need to see your boss," she told the paler woman standing guard at the bottom of Burt's staircase.
The woman held up her hand.
"It's after hours."
"He's right there," Flora said in frustration.
"He doesn't take visitors this time of night."
Flora thought about shoving her way past. Instead, she shouted his name. Burt looked up from a book and blinked at her.
"Bella!"
he said to the guard.
"Let her up!"
Bella glared daggers at Flora, but let her pass. Flora jogged up the stairs and joined Burt in his office, where he offered her a cigar. Something about his demeanour had changed since they'd last spoke, and he looked more cautious, eyeing her thoughtfully.
"Good morning, Verundish," he said.
Flora didn't return his smile.
"I'm here to offer you my services."
This seemed to catch him off guard.
"Oh? At this hour?"
He rubbed his chin.
"What makes you think I still need them?"
"Because everyone is panicking over that army headed this way, and Jezzy still has that other powder mage on her payroll."
"True, true," Burt admitted.
He puffed on the stub of his cigar and put it out, then leaned forward at his desk and began to fiddle with a new cigar, running it thoughtfully under his nose and breathing deeply as he watched her.
"About that army," he said slowly. "What do you know about it?"
"Absolutely nothing," she said in a tone that she hoped would discourage any more questions. He obviously suspected something. With several powder majors in town, no one couldn't have been the only one to make the logical leap that they were related to Lady Flint's army camped nearby.
"Nothing?" he echoed.
"I know they're not here for your gold," she said, hoping that shut him up.
"Oh!"
Bert fell back in his chair, an obvious look of relief on his face.
"Well then, what sort of services are you offering?"
"I'm offering to kill that other powder mage for you. I want to duel him. Public, private, I don't care. Set up a fight and dangle a wager in front of Jesse. The powder mage will come. I know he will."
Flora chewed on her lip, hoping that Bert would take her up on the offer.
No one was no longer a nuisance. He had almost killed her tonight, and she wanted him out of the picture completely before she and Taniel went after Prime Lecter. Bert cut the tip off the new cigar with a Boz knife he pulled out of a drawer, his eyes staring at the middle distance between them. Slowly, he began to nod.
"What do you want in exchange?"
"I want you to tell your men to stand down when the Riflejack army marches through. They aren't here for you. I don't want roadblocks or fighting or any such thing." She was taking an awful risk, admitting she was with the Riflejacks. Any fool who had read her description in the paper would be able to figure out who she really was. But she had to take that risk. She was out of time, and she needed to simplify the conclusion of this mission as much as possible.
"You're confident you can kill him, despite your wounds?" Bert asked, lighting his cigar. "Those hands look pretty banged up."
"Noan and I have already crossed paths once. He came away worse for it than I did." He tapped one fingernail against the blade of the knife.
"I have no interest in getting in anyone's way," he said. "If the Riflejacks aren't after my gold, I have no problem with them."
"You know that Lady Flint has a price on her head?"
"And an army of riflemen out there," Bert replied. "I'm not stupid enough to tangle with Adran's soldiers. Besides, the bounty is nothing compared to what this valley makes me every week. I'll offer Jesse a wager and a duel. You do some killing, and I think we'll part friends."
"I would like that," Flora said. She felt herself relax, knowing that the end of this damned mission was almost upon her. She was probably going to get all her soldiers killed in a confrontation with an ancient sorceress, she reasoned, but at least she wasn't going to have to rub shoulders with these people any more.
Chapter 46.
"What have you been doing in here the last couple of days?"
Mikkel looked up from his studies, taking a moment to pull his head out of long lists of family, household, and regiment names, and blink across the empty room to where Ictracia lounged on a divan in the sunlight. He thought, for the 100th time, of a cat playing with a mouse before the final kill, and forced a distracted smile onto his face.
"Do you mind if I call you Tricia?" he asked.
Ictracia raised one eyebrow.
"Only if I can call you Mick."
"Well, I'd rather not." "Oh, I see your point. That's fair."
Mikkel looked back down at the book laid out on the table in front of him. He was in a dusty room on the second floor of the Capitol building, where Yaret's people had stashed most of the records they'd brought with them from Dionysus. The floor-to-ceiling bookshelves were packed with ledgers, and thousands more sat in crates or piled up in the corners. Very little of it was organized in any useful way, and Mikkel had spent far too long just doing that. He considered Ictracia's still-raised eyebrow,
and remembered that she'd asked him a question. "I'm cataloguing everyone that Fagula has worked with since the beginning of the invasion."
"That seems like an awful lot of work."
Mikkel squinted at her. She was right, of course. It was mind-numbingly boring, something that he would prefer to leave to a small army of clerks. But he couldn't just tell her that he was combing the army regimental records for someone named Mara. "This is something we do in the Black Hats," he told her. "We had a file on just about every enemy of the state, and it included all their contacts and family members. It helped us unwind conspiracies and root out cells of dissidents." Mikkel had his own opinions on how useful those files actually were, but he needed the excuse to be up here, combing through all of these names.
"You should have someone else do that," Ectrasia said.
She stretched on the divan, a casual smile on her face, watching Mikkel in a way that made it very clear what she thought he should be doing. He'd spent the last two nights at her townhouse and learned firsthand how that particular rumour about privileged happened to be true. It had been a welcome bit of relaxation for sure, but it had also been incredibly distracting. She was damn distracting. She'd been lounging on that divan for 20 minutes, and Mikkel had read the same regimental record over and over again since she arrived. He couldn't stop glancing up at her, watching her face when she wasn't paying attention. He caught himself watching her again and rubbed his eyes. This search wasn't going anywhere. He'd looked through at least 20,000 names, and not a single Mara had popped up, not among the civilians nor the military. As Emerald had suggested, it wasn't even a Dionysus name. He felt like his hands were tied. His whole purpose here was to find and extract this Mara, but he'd run out of places to look.
"There was another bombing this afternoon."
"I heard," Mikkel answered. "Imagine the Black Hats won't stop the bombings just because their Dionysus patron has been cut off."
"Sedgel is just biding his time, by the way."
Mikkel looked up sharply. Ectrasia was cleaning her nails, lips pursed. Switching from the bombing to Sedgel so quickly seemed like a non sequitur, but she didn't look distracted. Mikkel said, "I'm not sure what you mean."
"That stunt with Fagula. He'll take it personally. He takes everything like that personally. Sooner or later, and I'm guessing sooner, he'll start asking Yaret why the bombings haven't been stopped. He'll ask why Fagula's death didn't put an end to the attacks, and why Yaret's pet Black Hat hasn't dug up his former compatriots yet."
Mikkel was more than aware of all this, or at least he'd surmised it. Having his suspicions about Sedil's anger be confirmed wasn't exactly comforting. "I'm looking," he assured her. "We have hundreds of people out trying to dig up Jatura's hiding spot. We've searched every safe house that I know about and looted all their caches. We've arrested nearly 400 known Black Hats."
"And yet Jatura is staying one step ahead of you."
Mikkel pursed his lips, trying to keep a neutral expression. Ectrasia was friendly, even charming, but he had to constantly remind himself that she was a privileged. All she had to do was put on her gloves and she could break him in two. So it was best not to snap at her when she needled. "I've no idea how. Jatura will need dozens of men to conduct his bombings. He needs a network to supply the powder, make the bombs, and case the targets. We've scrubbed the city of his people as thoroughly as we damn well can, and yet he still evades me." Mikkel sat back, grinding his teeth.
"Oh, don't look so put out," Ectrasia murmured.
She rolled off the divan and crossed the room, coming around behind Mikkel. To his surprise, she began to rub his shoulders.
"Look, I see what you're doing here,"
she said gently.
If you create a web of conspiracy around Forgoola, true or not, then you'll be able to keep Sedul on the back foot. You can accuse his people, keep the other households in suspicion of his motives, and perhaps stay ahead of him.
Mikkel felt himself stiffen up. Ictrasia's tone was helpful, but he couldn't help but hear a note of something sinister in her words. That was exactly what he had convinced Yarrett he was up here doing, and Ictrasia had seen through it effortlessly.
It didn't bode well for his long-term career in Dainai's politics. "What I suggest," Ictrasia continued, "is that you focus on the Black Hats. Even if you attack all his people, you won't get ahead of Sedul. He's been playing this game for longer than you and I together have been alive. But if you continue to add to your accomplishments, you'll be harder for him to take his vengeance on. And he has been known to be forgiving to people who make themselves useful."
Mikkel tried to enjoy the back rub, pressing the back of his head against her chest. Rumours had it that Ictrasia and her grandfather didn't exactly get along, so maybe she really was on his side. Or perhaps she was lulling him into a false sense of security. He pushed the book away from him, eyes closed, trying to form his own plans.
"Do I have a future with the Dainais?" he asked.
Ictrasia's hands stopped moving.
"Why do you ask?"
"Because I'm an outsider. I know what happens to outsiders. The moment I'm no longer useful, I will be either forgotten or destroyed."
"You should have thought of that before coming to our doorstep."
Again, the tone was not unkind, but in it she made it very clear that she'd be offering little sympathy. She paused, then let out a soft sigh.
"You may," she said cautiously. "You're quite clever, though whether you're just the right amount to keep from being eaten alive remains to be seen. You're also useful. I've always thought of the Dainais as xenophobic, but next to you Cressians, we're practically loving of other cultures."
She let go of his shoulders and crossed to the other side of the table from him.
"Put away the books," she suggested. "Come to the Foxhead Club with me for the rest of the evening."
The Foxhead Club was a bit of a joke among the Dainais. They'd taken an exclusive gentleman's club in the centre of Landfall and turned out the Cressians, making it available only to Dainais and Palo upper crust. Mikkel wondered briefly if he'd be turned away, but imagined that no one would turn away the guest of a privileged. He leaned forward, examining her face, wondering what time it was. Perhaps he should take a break.
"Where do you fit into all of this?" he asked.
"All of what?"
"This."
Mikkel gestured expansively around him. "Sedul, Yarrett, the households. Tenik told me that privileged aren't allowed to be political in your culture. In Cressian culture they have their fingers in everything, and..." Mikkel trailed off, realizing that he'd let himself forget who he was talking to. When he was in the Black Hats, he probably would have balked at even addressing a privileged, let alone speaking so candidly with one. Ictrasia regarded him casually, tapping on the table with one long fingernail.
"It is complicated, as you may imagine."
She paused, frowning down at her hands, and for a moment Mikkel thought that perhaps her cool, collected mask had slipped.
"Do you know about dragon men?"
she asked. "I've heard the rumours."
"Dragon men and privileged hold the same position in Dainai society. We belong to the Emperor. We are not people, nor citizens. We are tools. When we are needed, we serve without flinching, without questioning. When we are not needed, we are left to our own devices. We have no power of our own, not in a political sense, but we have a sort of power simply by being tools of the Emperor."
Mikhail opened his mouth to respond, but found he had nothing to say. The idea of being a possession had never even occurred to him, and the slight crack in Ictrasia's voice when she spoke of it told volumes.
He hesitated. If you're a possession of the Emperor's, and Sediel is the Emperor's man on this continent, then...
Ictrasia's slipping facade suddenly became cool and casual again, and she regarded him with a dispassionate sort of annoyance.
I wouldn't worry too much about your own skin. Sediel may think he is the Emperor, but he definitely is not. It's no secret that he and I do not get along. I've no intention of handing you over to him.
I didn't mean...
She cut him off. It's all right. You want to know where you stand, and I won't begrudge you that. So here is this. I find you fascinating. You are an innocuous and boring person on the surface, but there are layers beneath your facade that I think I'd enjoy peeling away. I intend on playing with you for at least a few months before I cut you loose and move on to the husband of a minister or the daughter of a general. I will enjoy our time together, and I suspect you intend on doing the same. Do not expect anything more of me than you would a tool of the state, and I won't expect anything more of you than I would a spy who knows he needs someone to protect him from the lions among my people.
For a moment, Mikhail felt as if he'd been slapped. The shock was gone within seconds, and he found himself laughing.
"What's so funny?" Ictrasia demanded.
Mikhail reached out a hand.
"Thank you for that. It's incredibly refreshing."
She knew that he was using her to protect himself from Sediel, and she didn't give a damn. Somehow that knowledge relieved Mikhail, the idea that he wasn't hiding just one more thing from another person. "I'm sorry if I'm being rude, but you're far more pragmatic than I expected. I like that." Ictrasia took his hand with a look of wariness. Slowly, that feline smile spread across her face.
"Don't apologize. It's tiresome, and I don't want to find you tiresome quite yet."
She released his hand and slid the ledger he'd been reading off the table with a clatter.
"Your work is done for the night. Come with me to the club."
"Can I meet you there?"
"How long?"
"An hour."
"Don't keep me waiting."
With a single glance back, Ictrasia strode from the room. Mikhail waited for about 10 minutes before cleaning up the ledgers he'd been looking through, and then scrawling a quick note on a piece of paper and heading for the door. He stopped for a moment before leaving the room to look around at all the records, wondering how much longer he should continue with this farce. Ictrasia was right. He couldn't focus on looking through records any more. He needed to focus on the Black Cats. He could abandon the idea of attacking Sediel through Forgula's associates, and also set aside his search for Mara, at least for the time being. He headed across town on foot, doubling back and waiting at intervals to be sure he wasn't followed, then headed down into Emerald's morgue, where he found Emerald standing over the open chest cavity of a cadaver, a length of intestine in one hand. He paused his work as Mikhail entered and shook his head.
"You obviously haven't been shot again. I hope you have a damn good reason for coming down here so soon."
"Can you get a message to Taniel?"
Emerald responded, setting down the intestine and resting his hand on the cold, dead forehead of the man lying on his workbench.
"It's possible."
Mikhail pulled out the note he'd written and double-checked it, taking a deep breath. Perhaps it was his recent victory against Forgula. Perhaps it was this new relationship with Ictrasia. But he felt like he needed to focus on his work for the Dionys. No more searching ledgers for a mysterious name. The note simply said, "Target can't be found. Need more information. Will remain in place. It was written in a cipher he and Taniel had come up with years ago.
Get this to Taniel. Any idea how long until I can get an answer?
Emerald nodded at Mikkel to set the note on his workbench.
2 to 6 weeks. Maybe longer, if I have trouble finding him. I'll see what I can do.
He sighed, clearly irritated, and pointed at Mikkel with a bloody hand. You have to stop coming down here. If I hear back from Taniel, I'll find you and let you know. Until then...
Right, right. I'll be easy to find.
Mikkel backed out and headed up to the street. He stopped, checking his watch, and realizing he'd be half an hour later than he told Ectracia.
I'll either be in bed with the enemy, or in a shallow grave somewhere.
Chapter 47 Stike sat in the deep, oppressive darkness of the hawk, listening to the sounds of the forest and the distant snores of lancers in their beds. Unable to sleep, he'd found a spot on the edge of a ravine some 50 yards from the camp, where he could see the smallest sliver of starlight through the thick branches overhead. Somewhere nearby, a critter stirred in the underbrush, approaching him slowly and fleeing when he shifted to get more comfortable. His mind was a mess of conflicting thoughts as he considered the whole of his life for the first time since the labor camps, and wondered if perhaps he was not the person he'd always fancied himself. He thought of Valjean's statements about Stike expecting loyalty and obedience, but never giving his own. He thought about Celine's defiance in defense of Carpole, reminding him that he would, and had, gone off on his own and just expected the Lancers to be there when he returned. It was one thing to be called a hypocrite by a full-grown man he intended to kill. It was a whole other to have that confirmed by a little girl. Stike wondered if, perhaps, all these years, even while losing himself in the labor camps, he bought into his own legend, that of an unkillable monster, a force of nature. Maybe, deep down, he had begun to believe what people said about him. He heard someone coming from the camp through the underbrush toward him. He could tell from the weight of the step and the way she moved that it was Ibana. She joined him up there, settling down next to him and pushing a skin into his hands. He smelled wine and took a sip.
"What are you doing up here?"
she asked.
"It's 4 in the morning.
"Couldn't sleep,"
Stike responded. They shared a few companionable minutes in silence, handing the wineskin back and forth, and Stike felt a calmness come over him from Ibana's presence. They'd not been this close, physically, since the war, and it felt good to feel her hand brush his as they exchanged the wine. She'd been a guidepost since the beginning of the Mad Lancers, his level-headed second-in-command, the one who would keep everything running even when he had to meet with Lindit or assassinate an enemy general, or any of the other shit he got up to.
"I've been thinking," Stike began.
"I warned you to let me do the thinking."
There was a long pause, and Ibana let out a soft sigh.
"About what?" "About being a hypocrite."
Ibana snorted.
"Still? Is this because Valjean called you one?"
"Celine did too, just a couple of hours ago. I think that I am, and I don't really like the feeling it gives me. I've always looked down on officers and politicians as hypocrites and cowards, and now, so long into this life, I realize that I am what I've always derided."
Ibana remained silent, so Stike continued.
"I am a hypocrite. But I think I'm too far along for it to be helped. To break my hypocrisy, I would have to swear allegiance to some higher power, or I would have to dismiss the Mad Lancers and head off on my own path. I'm not willing to do either."
He felt Ibana shake beside him, and it took him several moments to realize that she was laughing at him.
What the pit is so funny?
She put a hand on his thigh and leaned over, and he was surprised to feel her lips against his cheek. She pulled away, wiping her sleeve across her eyes and chuckling.
You really think you're a hypocrite? Well, I'll give you one thing. You were a hypocrite. Your double standard during the war was something we all decided to let slide because of who and what you are.
So you discussed this? Stike asked, incredulous. Behind my back?
You think you're the only one to badmouth your superiors?
Stike felt stung by the revelation. It was so simple, so stupid and obvious. Another hypocrisy.
What am I? He asked.
You're Ben Stike.
Because you say I am, Stike insisted.
He felt angry, confused. He was not used to delving this deep into his own insecurities. He'd always trampled them underfoot, ignoring them like so much garbage, and moved on with his life. Why couldn't he now? The old way had gotten results, and he needed results right now.
You're not just Ben Stike because we say you are, though I admit that the allegiance of the people who follow you gives your name weight, Ibana said thoughtfully. You're Ben Stike because you always lead the charge. Because you can break a warden's back and crack a dragon man's skull. Because you're big and strong enough to do whatever you want, and yet you still have a sense of right and wrong. Even if it's a twisted one.
Stike stared through the darkness at his crippled hands, feeling the twinges in his wrist when he moved his fingers. He thought about how his doubt and pain went away when he wrapped his fingers around the lance, and how all his other failings seemed to disappear when he charged into the face of the enemy.
You're not a hypocrite, Ben, Ibana said. You were, but you aren't any more.
I haven't changed.
Haven't you? Ibana demanded. The old you wouldn't have spread Tennywiles or Valjean. Definitely not Devouri. Not a chance. The old you wouldn't have sworn allegiance to Lady Flint.
Seeing the way you look at her, it's the first time I've seen you truly respect a superior officer.
She ticked off two fingers, then a third.
You took Celine under your wing, and you've always hated kids.
Besides, Ibana laughed again, you didn't ask any of us to follow you. We came because we saw that you needed us, not because we needed you.
Stike felt his inner turmoil begin to ebb.
You're a better liar than I remember.
No lies, Ibana said. Maybe I dressed it up a little, but it's still the truth, and I still stand behind what I said before. We're here now, and we're all depending on you to remain Ben Stike. You can be a different man and still lead the charges.
Do you think the men doubt me because I let Tenny, Valjean and Devouri live?
Stike asked.
Look, I know I gave you shit before, but to be honest, any grumbles that might have spread were silenced when we came upon you facing down six dragon men, Ibana said.
Stike chuckled.
I didn't do that by choice.
But you still did it.
Not a lot of people see six dragon men and draw a knife. Most of them will run.
Pitt, I'd run.
They finished off the wine, sitting in silence for some time before Ibana drew in a quick breath, then laughed softly.
What?
Stike asked.
It's Celine, she said, as if it were the simplest thing in the world.
What do you mean?
I mean that all these things, these doubts, these changes that have come over you, they're not because you faced a firing squad or spent a decade in the camps. They're because you have a child now.
Stike felt his face flush.
She's not mine.
Oh, please. I've heard you refer to her as my girl. You're not fooling anyone, least of all me. Celine is your child, whether she came from your loins or not, and that's made you a different man.
She turned toward him, and even in the darkness he could feel her piercing stare.
Tell me. Do you fear death?
Of course, Stike scoffed. Everyone fears death.
There's a difference between being suicidal and not fearing death, Ibana said. And the Ben I knew never feared death. So, do you? Sai thought about it for a moment. Death was such an abstract notion. It always felt so far away that he knew better than most that it could strike at any moment. He'd been within a knife blade of death on hundreds of occasions, and sometimes closer. When he said he feared death, it was a mechanical lie, said because that's what normal people were supposed to say. He had never feared death. Even when Fidelis Jess had cut him down, leaving him in a puddle of his own blood, he had not feared death. He had only feared leaving this world without taking Fidelis Jess with him. And, he realized, he had feared one other thing.
"I don't," he said. "But I fear leaving Celine alone."
"I call it the same thing," Ibana said, sitting back. "Fearing your death because you won't go on living, versus fearing your death because somebody else needs you, is just semantics."
"You fear for Celine, and I've never known you to fear. You look at her in a way you never looked at a friend, or a lover, including me."
Stike realized that he heard a note of hurt in her voice. He swallowed, uncertain of what to say, and decided to let it go. She'd not meant for him to hear it. He felt her hand on his thigh again, and her body shifted toward his. Her face drew close.
"Quiet the inner demons, Ben," she told him. "They've never been worth your time before, and they certainly shouldn't be now."
They were interrupted by the sound of hooves along the trail on the ridge above them. Ibana pulled away, and Stike listened as the hooves descended the road down into the hollow where the Lancers camped. He heard a distant voice that he recognized as Ferelizia's call his name. Ibana sighed, slapping him on the shoulder. "Go on. You got work to do." Reluctantly, Stike descended the ridge and headed into the camp. He found Ferelizia outside his empty tent, scowling at one of the guards. He put his hand on her shoulder, turning her around and gesturing for her to lower her voice.
"Did you find them?"
he asked.
"I did," she said excitedly. "They camped about 3 miles from here. They're not trying to hide, but they picked a place that would be suicide for us to attack. A hill just inside the eastern edge of the hog, with steep sides and only one spot that horses could easily climb. They have lots of wounded men and horses."
Stike took a deep breath. Carpole would be there, no doubt. She was resourceful enough that she was probably still alive, unless the enemy commander had orders to kill her in particular. He lifted his head, seeing Ibana emerge from the woods.
"Go find Shackle for me," he told her.
"Are we going to attack?" Ibana asked.
"Not exactly."
Chapter 48. Stike and Jackal were led to the Dragoon camp by Felizia, arriving just before sunrise. Too late to work beneath the cover of darkness, he sent Felizia back to camp, and he and Jackal huddled down in the hock and waited and watched throughout the day. The Dragoon camp was much as Felizia described it, packed onto a long wooden hill just inside the hock. The hill was surrounded on all four sides by steep, rocky cliffs, between 10 and 50 feet high, making it a solid defensive position against any force, and doubly impossible to attack with cavalry. There appeared to be only one easy way up, a gentle slope pointing east less than 24 feet wide and guarded heavily. The cries of wounded men and horses could be heard throughout the day, and the occasional carbine blast sounded as they put down lame animals. It became abundantly clear that the Dragoons didn't care if Stike knew where they were. Their defensive position was unbreakable by less than a brigade of infantry, and they knew that Stike didn't have that kind of firepower at his command. Nor, they must have surmised, did Strike want to take the time to starve them off their high ground. The Dynais could wait for as long as their supplies held out, tending to their men. The ambush must have cooled their commander, making Strike doubly angry at Carpole for sneaking off. If she'd stuck around, the Lancers would already be on their way to the coast. Strike lay on his stomach in the underbrush about 100 yards from the entrance to the hill, watching the dragoons change their guard as the daylight began to wane. Jackal lay beside him, apparently asleep, until his eyes suddenly opened and he got up onto his elbows, pointing at the hill.
"It's an old Palo settlement," he said. "I've been talking to the spirits. That hill, it was home to a village once. It's been a few 100 years, but there are some old spirits left hanging about. They fled because your bone eye is there."
Strike snorted. The idea that Carpole could scare long-dead spirits still seemed preposterous. But at least it confirmed that she was indeed here.
"Is she still alive?"
"According to the spirits, yes. It's hard to coax them to come this close to her."
"Can they tell us anything about the hill?"
"They called it the castle back when they lived there. Or their word for castle, anyway. As long as they held it, their tribe could not be ousted from their land."
"What happened?"
"Brudanian soldiers. They wanted to clear the hock so that trappers could use it. Lost half their regiment taking the castle from the Palo."
Jackal waggled a finger at the entrance to the castle.
"They tried to assault that and failed. Ended up putting ladders on the lowest cliffs on the south side and overwhelming the occupants with sheer numbers."
"Show me."
Strike and Jackal pulled back beneath the closest ridgeline and took a long, circuitous route around the castle. The dragoons had plenty of scouts, but they seemed to focus their efforts deeper in the hock, at the halfway point between their camp and that of the Mad Lancers. Other than hiding on occasion, Strike and Jackal reached the south side of the castle without issue. The cliffs here were indeed the lowest, perhaps 10 or 15 feet of near-vertical rock. A single dragoon stood watch at the top, peering into the forest as darkness began to spread, cradling his carbine. Strike continued along the south side and looped around to the west, searching for better spots to climb the cliffs, and finding nothing that looked promising. He returned to Jackal, falling onto his hands and knees to watch that one dragoon patrol the top of the shallow cliff.
"Do you remember the fortress at New Adapest?"
Strike asked. Jackal's placid face wrinkled, the hint of a smile on his lips.
"I remember it. I'm not as spry as I used to be," Strike said.
He wanted very badly to climb the cliff and do the job himself, but he did not have confidence in his own abilities to do so in silence. He shot a glance at the wound on Jackal's leg.
"Are you?"
"None of us are," Jackal replied. "But I think I'm up to the task."
He touched his leg.
"This looks worse than it is. And there were a lot more guards at New Adapest."
Twilight was quickly upon them, and Strike and Jackal got to their feet. They moved slowly through the underbrush, careful not to make too much noise, until they were at the very base of the castle cliff. The guard had changed, and another man now patrolled this small section, torch in hand. Jackal waited until the guard had passed and began his ascent, climbing the cliffside in almost complete silence. He shimmied up, grasping the old roots and reaching the top in less than a minute, just as the guard came back in his direction. Strike pressed himself against the cliff to hide from the light of the torch. Silence followed, though Strike strained to listen for a grunt or a yell. A few moments later, he heard a distinctive psst and began his own ascent. He reached the top to find Jackal standing over the body of the sentry. Jackal stood stiffly, his posture all wrong, like a deer too scared to run.
"Everything okay?"
Stike whispered. Jackal nudged the body with his foot.
"He just offed himself." "What?"
Jackal came close, leaning in to whisper in Stike's ear.
"I stepped on a twig. He turned to look at me, and instead of shouting out, he drew his knife and slit his own throat."
The hairs on the back of Stike's neck stood up, goosebumps spreading on his arms. He knelt beside the body and found the guard clutching his own knife, still lightly convulsing, as he silently bled out onto the dirt. Stike reached out to touch him, but pulled his hand back, thinking better of it. He leaned over, putting his nose up next to the body. He took a deep breath, catching hints of copper. He stood up to find Jackal's knife out, breath held, staring toward a pair of Dionized dragoons about 30 feet away. Stike held his breath, waiting for a shout as the pair slowly approached them. Stike readied his boss knife, preparing to spring forward when they got close enough, but was arrested when they spoke out in unison in perfect Adran.
"You're wanted at the commander's tent, Colonel Stike."
Jackal's lips were pulled back in a snarl, nostrils flared.
"I can't see a spirit for a mile," he said. "Even the ones I was talking to back in the forest have fled."
"Please," the pair of dragoons said again, "you're wanted at the commander's tent."
Their words were mechanical, their backs straight and faces forward, though they stood at an angle to Stike and Jackal.
"Follow us."
They turned in unison and marched into the camp. Stike kept his knife handy, looking at Jackal and seeing the whites of his eyes. He'd never seen Jackal this startled, not even facing down privileged sorcery on an open battlefield.
"I've never seen anything like this,"
Jackal whispered.
"Is this her sorcery?"
"I think it is," Stike said.
"Or the sorcery of a Boni who wants us to think it's Karpol. But I didn't know the Bonis are capable of this kind of control."
Hesitating just a moment longer, he followed the pair of guards into the camp, Jackal bringing up a reluctant rear. The camp was quiet, with the occasional cook fire burning to coals, and only a handful of Dionys up and about. None of them seemed to notice Stike and Jackal, and he wondered if they were also under some kind of sorcery, or if they were just that inattentive within their own camp. He heard the occasional scream or moan from the east, the wounded from the other day's ambush, and they passed a corral in the open centre of the hill where nearly 300 horses were tied up for the night. The two guards suddenly stopped in between a row of tents, stepping in different directions, and gesturing for Stike to go ahead. He looked over his shoulder at Jackal, who still looked like an animal who wasn't sure whether to attack or run. With a shrug, Stike continued between the two guards. There was a large clearing in front of a tent bigger than all the others around it, no doubt belonging to the company commander. A well-stocked fire and a handful of torches illuminated a macabre scene in the middle of the clearing. 2 dozen Dionized soldiers, all of them wearing epaulets that marked them as officers, sat cross-legged in 2 rows on either side of the clearing. They didn't look up when Stike approached, or seem to move at all. They were so inhumanly still that he wondered if they were still alive. Across from the tent stood the officer that Stike had brawled with when they ambushed the Mad Lancers a few weeks back. Her hands were clasped behind her back, her spine straight. She had the same expression as Jackal, with eyes wide and lips pulled back. But hers was as strangely frozen as those of the men flanking her. Years ago, Stike had been present when a gift had been sent from the King of Kes to then-Governor Lindet of Redstone. The gift consisted of several life-sized facsimiles of Kes soldiers done up in wax. They were so well done that they looked like the real thing, until they began to melt in the Fatrastan heat.